Yeah, I'll let Gustavo share more, but I think at the core, I think it gets really underestimated how when you have a new custody format, right? It's never existed. It's very robust. It's pretty direct on how it works, but there's a heavy amount of education and learnings where we think when the market where it eventually goes is if everyone is going to hold Bitcoin to preserve their wealth, whether it's a business or individual, it'll just be secondary. It's like clicking a browser. You'll just know it works. You'll put your credit card information in. There was encryption in the same way, like you'll adopt and buy Bitcoin. You won't have to worry about the things that for the first 17 years people had to deal with. But the point being is for the past 3 years, that's what we've been heavily focused on, from the sales repetitions to the marketing to the collateral. And so to the extent that we can help Audio and other portfolio companies in opening that up, that's something that we've been working with him on and just across the board, because there's just a lot of inertia that we built by just focusing on this every day.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. Today, we're bringing you both sides of the Bitcoin venture story, sitting down with Gustavo Flores, founder of Audio, and Michael Tanguma from Early Riders. We're diving into multi-institutional custody, treasury management, and what it takes to build Bitcoin financial services in Latin America. Let's get into it. Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. I'm co-host Israel Munoz, and I'm joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow. Today, we welcome Michael Tanguma from Early Riders and Gustavo Flores from Audio. A bit of a unique episode as we have the investor and the founder of a recent deal that was announced, and we're excited to get into all of it. Again, welcome Michael and Gus. We're very excited to get into today's conversation with you both.
Excited to be here. Lots to talk about. You know, you guys being close to Mexico City and seeing what Gustavo's been working on, I figured you were pretty intimately familiar with all the things happening as far as the Audio kind of rebrand and growth. So excited to get into the details there.
Thank you, Israel. Lynn, great to be back here. A lot to unpack. Let's get to it.
Well, maybe to set the stage, Gustavo and Michael, can you give the listeners a bit of an idea of your background? Of course, Gustavo, if you could also let us know exactly what Audio does as far as Bitcoin services in Mexico. But I mean, each of you come from, of course, distinct backgrounds. Can you tell us how you both connected and the basics of what this recently announced deal was?
Yes, yeah, certainly. So, I got started in Bitcoin when I was quite young, and it's been a long journey. This is my third company that I built in Bitcoin. I worked at multiple other startups. So Audio, what we do is we provide both a technological platform for people to buy, sell, custody Bitcoin, and access other financial services, as much for investors as for companies. The technological platform we provide, we're very focused on personalized service, as like white glove service for private clients and for all sorts of clients. Right now, we're very much taking the time to talk to every customer, everyone that's interested to simply understand how Bitcoin custody works, wants to buy their first Bitcoin, wants to dig deeper on the topic, wants to review their current setup, or simply wants to talk about risks in Mexico and in the world and why Bitcoin is the solution to that. We're running a very strong campaign where we're just reaching out to people and talking to everyone as much as possible. But Audio in the end is both the technology and the personalized service, and that's how we differentiate ourselves.
Awesome. And quick background. So traditional background in technology, I was at Google, my Bitcoin journey or story goes, I was lighting money on fire with Adam Neumann at WeWork while I was learning about money, reading the Bitcoin Standard back in 2017. Went down the rabbit hole, as anyone does, has to really deeply understand custody if you're going to hold material amounts of Bitcoin on a personal balance sheet. Ended up joining a firm very early in 2019, 2020 called Unchained, was one of the first employees or first clients and then employees, scaled that business up, helped set up a fund, 1031. And the process of that really had to dig deep and learn, what's going on in this world. Because I think during 2020 to 2022, It was very chaotic. When you think about ZIRP in 2021, everyone knows those vintages will probably more than likely never get repaid back across the world. When you think about interest rates, I still look at the property I have here today. It was a 2.3% interest rate that we got in 21. This is when, you know, money was flying, stimmies were going out. And point being is, come into 2022, interest rates start rising and the market starts to collapse across the digital asset space. And you start to look around and you start to question things. It's always when the market falls apart as everyone, the things start to fester internally, externally. And so I decided to take a step back from everything I was working on and set up a multi-institution with OnRamp. That was when I set up that business, I was scared to see liquidity drown out the soundness of that business. I was scared to see it get ruined by too much money, because that was like the common thread I had seen for 15 years of my career, was those excess dollars just kind of kill the strategic nature, the unit economics, the growth. You see the layoffs, you saw everything across the board in the traditional space and the Bitcoin space. So spent my personal balance sheet, bootstrapped the business. And as we were going through that process, started to realize, oh God, this is actually kind of interesting, because whether it's hiring, the usage of AI and other deflationary tools, to how we just think about very like prudent business building, we started running laps and circles around the competition and how fast we were growing and what we were doing. And it was like, oh wait, this is actually interesting, because when your hurdle rate is greater than fiat or a dollar, and you can raise, and it's hard to raise money, or you're spending your own money, you start to get really efficient with how you're building. And that's just a competitive force against anybody else that doesn't necessarily have that like tightness when it comes to the dollars raised, where they come from, and then their purchasing power increasing. And so having the background in traditional tech and then venture, I started to really look back and realize, oh God, so this is actually, if all companies in the future will outcompete other companies if their denominator is stronger, because not only do they have a stronger balance sheet that will grow into the future, but they will be more discerning and efficient with capital spend. On the other side of that is, on a long enough time horizon, us four, I definitely think, are there, and probably most listeners are already there, but the rest of the world will catch up to, why would you give any Bitcoin up for an investment unless you have a credible reason that you would get more Bitcoin in the future? So you marry those two together, and we had this aha moment back in 22. This is how all capital formation will occur in the future. The white paper came out and Early Riders was born. Early Rider sits right next to OnRamp. We have a number of tailwinds on our backs. One of them is multi-institution custody. So we don't solely invest in businesses building on multi-institution, but we think we're ahead of that area of the market before the rest of the market's woken up. And so rather than try to go and convince other Bitcoin companies, which we have, but they don't see it yet, to adopt it, we realize, well, we can just actually go and either incubate or invest very early at the ground up in companies that are interested in building on we look at it as a better design surface for Bitcoin financial products, because of the custody, it's more robust, you can have reoccurring revenue, you can theoretically sell more Bitcoin, you can offer other financial services, you can retain that client relationship. And so fast forward, Gustavo and I have actually known each other since, I'd say 2020, in his Verify days. When I was at Unchained, we connected around, Verify was really well known in Canada for the content that they produced before the acquisition. And I don't know if it was necessarily through Nate or how we got in touch, but we got in touch, we started discussing, and then we can maybe go deeper there. But that's basically how we got together in the past 12 months.
Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, where we use our network of venture capital partners and startup founders to connect investors with unique opportunities within the Bitcoin innovation space. Alongside this, we help startup founders with their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
Yeah, I'm especially interested in that story about how the two of you connected. And it's not surprising to me that you did, but that's fascinating that you two knew each other before the Swapito journey. And I just want to point out for our listeners that we do have full episodes with interviews with Michael, specifically about OnRamp and Early Riders, and also with Gustavo about Swapito, which was the name of Aureo prior to this evolution in your product design. But let's talk a little bit about how you evolved Swapito into Aureo and why you saw the changes needed, Gustavo, and then we'll get into some of the deal points.
Yeah, certainly. I launched Swapito about a year, maybe 14 months ago. My goal was to launch a product that I could personally use, I and my co-founders could use, where we would easily spend Bitcoin in Mexico. And our first idea was that there was at least a couple hundreds or maybe a couple thousands Bitcoiners like us that had the same problem and needed the same solution. And it turned out that we were able to definitely launch this product and seize the existing market, but it made me realize that Bitcoin in Mexico is way behind that, for example, in Canada, where not only you have just a larger, let's say, just a smaller pool of investors, but the way these investors are using Bitcoin, the way people are using Bitcoin also differs a lot. For example, a business that allows you to pay your bills in Bitcoin in Australia or in Canada, that targets around, let's say, a couple tens of thousands of users. I know because I worked at those companies. I've been close to people that run these companies. However, the size of that market, the people that are spending Bitcoin and stable coins to pay their bills, is 1% of that in Mexico. So we're just extremely behind in that topic. People are still haven't understood the difference between Bitcoin and the rest. Why is Bitcoin necessary? We're just many years before we can even talk about how to use Bitcoin in different ways than just long-term investment. Because of that customer feedback, because of connecting with the Mexican community through the events and things we do in Mexico City, and through the conversations I had with Michael and his team, it just made sense to evolve the mission of Swapito to Audio's mission, where now our goal is to make Bitcoin the default saving technology in Latin America, starting with Mexico. So I think that main pivot in mission is the reason why we rebranded as well. Also, Swapito sounds very much something that is focused on speed, precisely because Swapito is the combination of swap and clapido, which means fast in Spanish. We wanted to focus not just on speed and user experience, but instead on long-term security and trust, which is why Audio came along. Audio represents the first gold coin of the Roman Empire, the one that was used during the growth of the Roman Empire, but it also means just something that is golden, like in Latin, and also in Spanish. It kind of symbolizes the trust we want to share and the security we want to build. And I think it also makes complete sense with the vision that we have around multi-institution custody that was greatly influenced by Michael and his team. When we started talking, this was not like part of my idea. Let's say that I had heard about this model, but I hadn't really understood why it was superior to other custody models. So through the conversations we had, I dug in deeper on this topic, and it just made sense for us to combine it all. It also made sense for the specific target market we're focusing on, which is Latin American high net worth investors. I think multi-institution custody is even more important here in Latin America than it is in other regions. And I'm sure we'll get into more of those details, but that's kind of the story of the rebrand.
And as far as the specifics on this deal, so Early Riders was an exclusive investor in Audio's recent fundraising, $1.1 million. And Michael, it was interesting to hear you talk about, you know, how Early Riders was born and how you thought that multi-institutional custody will be kind of the backbone of many different business models. And this is just such, this is your thesis kind of playing out, right? It's a company with a bold vision, who's going to be plugging in multi-institutional custody into their services. So what was the driver for you guys, Michael? I mean, why did you decide to take the strong vote of confidence in Audio being the exclusive investor in this deal, which says a lot?
Yeah, there's a lot there. Maybe just taking a quick step back, Lynn said something interesting earlier that it made me think about our paths crossing. Gustavo and mine. And when we talk about a lot of the things today, we're either very crazy or very right. So we'll figure it out either by the end of the pod or maybe by the end of the decade. At least I'll claim it for myself. I won't speak for Gustavo. But what we found ourselves, like, part of what I wanted to add some credence for what we'll hear is we just had a lot of time in the market. So when I look back, because everyone knows this industry is generally a one-way door. Once people get in, they usually stay in unless they ruin their reputation. So we can talk about, if you guys want to go down the digital asset treasury stuff, I think that could have some ramifications on reputation. But the point being is if your reputation and you care about it and you step in, you're generally going to be here today from 17 or 14 and then in 27 and 30. And I was thinking when Lynn brought this up, like Alex Dorn as an example, I was working with him at Fidelity when he was at Fidelity back in 17 before he went to Galaxy. And there was guys at Genesis, Matt Odell is a great example. Me and him connected over cold DMs back in like 17 or 18. So it's just a very small group. And so Gustavo and us connecting is pretty much the norm in this industry that you generally, it's a one-way door. You end up connections for a while. But then also a lot of the things we'll discuss here, I believe we're fundamentally right, but it's not that like necessarily being visionaries or being special. It's just because we've had so much time in the market that you get to, as long as by definition of keeping your reputation, staying alive, you get to start to see pattern recognition and realize, oh God, like this didn't actually work exactly like this, but this subtle twist is really what will like define maybe a generational company. And we've seen this in technological and cycles and innovations. When you think about the first people through the door aren't necessarily the winners. They kind of like teach the second wave to come through. The easy example is like the MySpaces of the world. Somebody had to come and establish a playbook, and then somebody came behind social media. So anyway, with all that said, this is the thesis that Israel had brought up around, well, what are we looking at? And we're looking at businesses that our fundamental thesis are the best category winners haven't been developed across the world. And one of the big reasons why is because when you really dig deep enough, multi-institution just becomes a better foundational design surface, custody layer for financial products, for financial services across the board. Easy example is inheritance. Like, how can you plan for inheritance for 35 years if you have to trust a single entity? No entity has lasted for 35 years from a custodial perspective, and no device has lasted for 35 years. So you generally have a gap. And maybe it's not a gap if you put 2% of your net worth, but what happens when somebody puts 50 to 98% of their net worth, which I think we all believe over time people will get there? You need robust market structure if we're ever going to get to $10 to $100 trillion asset class. These things aren't discussed. The other example outside of inheritance is like tax advantage accounts, things that compliantly have to be managed by certain governments. Well, you leave it with a single institution has historically been the standard, but no institution lasts till retirement. So that's 30. I mean, no custodial solution has lasted for that long. And then no device historically has lasted that long. So you start to like peel back the layers. We can go to insurance and other products. But the point being is that's been our thesis of as businesses build. To take it a little bit further, you can start to extrapolate businesses that have been theoretically talked about, like bit bonds and Bitcoin and real estate. But an example to bring it bring it home is everyone knows in investing, layering on multiple assumptions is a way to ruin, right? Like if you're going, okay, this has to happen and this has to happen and this has to happen, like as soon as you get away from the first or second assumption, you're basically throwing away money almost. Point being is, how can you build financial products like bit bonds or other things that are going to infuse Bitcoin into long-term capital when you're assuming that the underlying custodian will just be there when historically it hasn't been there? I.e. multi-institution, you got to have this like delegation and governance where a custodian can't move or lose the asset. And then if they do try, the asset still retained is secure. So hopefully that just gives you like how we look at the marketplace of financial services. We can go deeper if you'd like, but the overarching theme is specifically as time and value of Bitcoin grows, this will just become ubiquitous and understood because other exchanges will either be hacked, lose assets, rehypothecate, the price appreciates. We understand that as that happens, more bad actors know that this stuff sits in our house. People start to wake up, don't want their family to be at risk for holding Bitcoin. And this naturally just starts to be understood. And this is kind of why I gave the preamble about being long enough in the market. It's just thousands of conversations, billions of dollars have been onboarded, via my time at Unchained and OnRamp, that you start to realize maybe that initial 0.1% of Bitcoin adopters is not how this is going to get to be, 10, 20, 50% of global populations.
Build with Bitcoin is a proud affiliate partner of River. River is a financial services company that allows you to purchase, sell, and transfer your Bitcoin all through a great suite of products, high security standards, and as of recent, even allowing you to earn a Bitcoin yield on your US dollar cash deposits. For a personalized onboarding experience, go to partner.river.com/buildwithbitcoin.
I'd like to kind of step aside a little bit. So, Michael, you're talking about the landscape of financial services surrounding Bitcoin, just, you know, we're kind of figuring things out and seeing exactly how it's going to make sense in the future. When you're choosing to invest in a company that's working in this space, how important is the founder, since it's not a sure path forward? So can you talk to us a little bit about how you as an investor consider the importance of a founder and what you saw in Goose, especially since you had a front seat into Adam Neumann and WeWork, which is one of the probably most infamous founders in terms of successful fundraising and how that all turned out. But it's that you must have some strong feelings about the aspects or the personality characteristics of a founder that you make them investable for you.
Yeah, I mean, funny enough, a little crap for saying this, but like Adam Neumann has been one of the, I think, most interesting, I don't know, and it depends on the stage to be able to back him. But when you think about a founder or leader from charisma, being able to raise capital, sell, visionary, come up with ideas, like I think the problem with WeWork fundamentally is they got outside of their skis because, again, it goes back to the money. If people give you $4 billion, $16 billion, and this happened with Uber and Lyft, right? When the money cannon's pointed at you, they talked about it. They tell you to take it. And if you don't take it, they're just going to point it at your competitor. They're going to give it to your competitor and point it at you. And so it just becomes this like very, if you don't understand money, you don't have the right discernment. I think that's where he got in a lot of traps. But either way, when I think about there's two sides of early stage investing that I think most people are generally familiar with is the founders, the main thing, the founding member, the founding team. Because at the end of the day, what you're really planning for is for somebody to be long-term oriented, to get knocked in the face a bunch of times and then not like stay down because and to iterate. You know, Bezos talks about this all the time, the idea maze, that everyone is happy with how successful they've been, but reality is they failed more times than they've been successful and they just reverse really quickly and go into the next path. And that's how you get to success, is you have to iterate. So what I think about that's interesting is Gustavo's background, having founded business before, specifically in this space, because I think that is very much widely under-discussed and underappreciated, that when you build in Bitcoin, you might as well be building on another planet. Like, we can talk about leaving another planet when you're building with the sound money and having to be really discerning because of the level of ZERP and low interest rates that have existed. And almost everyone wants to be a founder of venture capital. But you take that level and then you add building Bitcoin financial services in that level of what are Bitcoiners or Bitcoin investors willing to pay for, or what will they tolerate? And that becomes just a whole different slew. And so generally having that experience, and again, all of these things come from firsthand experience from my background and having built in Bitcoin and having understood that, okay, ran through the door, didn't necessarily work out, found a better solution with multi-institution, kind of know where the quote unquote bodies are buried because you know not what to do and what not to do. So you learn from that. So that was a big component. And then the last one I'll say is we really look at early stage investments because you have to have the fundamentals there. Peter Thiel talks really great about this in his book, Zero to One, about if the foundation of any endeavor, doesn't matter if it's a business endeavor or a relationship with a spouse, if it's cracked at the foundation, or family, if it's cracked at the foundation, that crack will show itself throughout the life of the building or that relationship. And I've seen this firsthand at businesses when the foundation's not correct, whether it's how the founder equity's set up, maybe it's the vision of the business and then where it goes to its success. And the vision wasn't initially at the start the same as what made it successful. It ends up showing up later down the road. And I bring this up because it goes back to the unit economics and how you build the business from the start. When you think about the number of businesses that have raised X millions of dollars, diluted themselves, hired a bunch of people, when you start going down that path, it's very hard to regress or reverse back and to get it on track because you've already created a bunch of like layers of fat and bureaucracy. And so it was very interesting when Gustavo and I met, for all the time he'd spent in the industry, everything he saw work and not work, and then ultimately understand from his personal balance sheet, manage Bitcoin for himself, you can start to recognize, well, if that is what he has already, then when you start a business, you're going to be able to layer in all those learnings. And again, this is just kind of pattern recognition from what we built with OnRamp. And that's what fed into a lot of our discussions and, you know, making the decision to invest.
What stands out from your comments there, Michael, to me at least, is I kind of heard resiliency and adaptability are two very important characteristics for a successful founder. And I mean, that connects a bit into how a startup founder and capital allocator might think about structuring a deal partly in Bitcoin, which was a component of this deal, because it is a volatile asset, right? It's hard money. We know that, but it's certainly got its ups and downs, and you got to be ready to kind of adapt to that, right? And just plan for the medium to long term. So to that point, I'd love to get both your takes on, and if you can share the mechanics of that partial Bitcoin raise, but more important than that, how you think about any short-term downturn, which we're currently, you know, late November, sorry, that this is being recorded. There's lots of people that are a bit scared about the recent 30% drawdown. Anyone who's been in Bitcoin long enough knows that these are actually quite common and tend to be relatively short-lived. So as long as you are planning for the long term, it's nothing to be, you know, too concerned about, as long as you have some runway. But I'd love to get both of your takes on how you think about deal structure with a volatile asset.
So, Gustavo, what I'll do is I'll share a framework for how we think about it for an external perspective and how we thought about it for OnRamp. And then it's up to you how much you want to share about any of the mechanics. We can keep it high level or go deep, but I'll lean on you there. So just to give some insight or lens into one component is like return profile, because again, just in the sense of being hyperbolic and saying some things that are a little noisy or spicy, is people fundamentally believe you can't return more Bitcoin because they have no creativity. Like, that's what fiat has bred, is people believe that like Bitcoin is just this panacea for like everything. It's the best performing thing and it'll always be. And it's like, well, Bitcoin's just money. And so if you have an entrepreneur that has creative juices, and what you said about resiliency and can come up with ideas and adaptability and has spent time in the market delivering value, well, then it's kind of crazy to not believe that they can't make more Bitcoin because they already have everything there and then they have the underlying unit. So that's just from a first principle perspective, how we look at the landscape. And we looked at it from our own perspective when we built OnRamp, because I could have given away 10 to 20% of the business to get some money and de-risked it for myself. I didn't have to spend my Bitcoin. I could have gone out to the market, have a whole Rolodex of VCs, could have called private capital, you know, but the point being is I would have given up 10 to 20% of that business. And I was looking at A, how much Bitcoin would have been spitting out from that I'd be giving up. And then what's the enterprise value that I expect of this business? And if I had to lend or invest 10 of my own Bitcoin in the business, well, I believe it would be worth much more than that. And so point being is that's how we kind of look at the opportunity set is in Bitcoin, especially if you have the right founders, the right foundational products and services. We see this today with like Privy, Bridge, Zero Hash. All these companies are buying these orchestration layers that are still playing in this like crypto, small wallet kind of, and they're paying billions of dollars for these businesses. So it makes zero sense when Bitcoin gets to 150, 175, 200 that people aren't going to pay a king's ransom for actual real wallet architecture and financial services across the world, because Bitcoin's money. Money requires financial services, and financial services are just localized because they're relationship driven. So that's how we start to look at the opportunities like Aria and others. Now, the last thing to call out is, because it's an important one, and this is where more art than science comes into play, is, well, weathering volatility and downturns. And there's two ways to look at this. One of them is ultimately how I looked at it personally is, if you have more bullets in the chamber, well, then you have more flexibility in what you do with your balance sheet. Meaning, I didn't raise any external money. We didn't go out to the market. We knew we had individuals interested. I knew I had personal Bitcoin on my balance sheet. So I was able to hold the Bitcoin on the balance sheet in OnRamp in all of Bitcoin. And it worked out really nicely, because when we founded the business was actually 3 years ago, almost to the date in 22, when the price of Bitcoin was $17,000. So we've been able to like manage that uptrend, and there's been volatile, but on a long enough time horizon, it's up and to your right. It's your favor. It's in your favor. But if I wasn't in that circumstance and I had no capital, had no savings, this was all we had, then you have to be a lot more, and nobody would give us more money until we saw traction, which is the reality of some entrepreneurs or startups. Well, then you have to be a lot more prudent and discerning with how you think about your treasury. And then there's everything in between, right? And how you manage it. The last thing I'll say is, I think it's kind of a psyop and a fallacy that Bitcoin is more volatile than the dollar, especially moving forward. Because when we look at what inflation truly is across the world, specifically just in the US, it's really 10 to 20%. So if you look at what inflation is in your local market or the United States. And then you look at, you know, Bitcoin's volatility, and you like look at it in that sense, you can start to get a better lens of like, is it more volatile or risky to hold all of your treasury in dollars? And that doesn't even account for, you know, the other things we can talk about with holding dollars versus Bitcoin. But hopefully that gives a good framework for at least how we like, we looked at it for OnRamp, and then that provides us the right lens to look at it for other companies. And then maybe Gustavo, if you want to share how you think about it and any kind of, you know, mechanics that are specifics, if you want to share.
Yeah, I'd like Gustavo to, because Gustavo, you're an unusual founder. This is your third startup that you've been involved with, and at a, I mean, starting at 18, but you've only been starting Bitcoin oriented companies. So I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on, you know, in those various companies, how much did a treasury play into the success of the company or issues with the company in terms of fundraising? How you've learned through that journey about holding Bitcoin versus holding dollars, and really what your perspective is that you might be able to share with other founders.
Definitely. So, well, my trajectory, just to get started with that, my first company was a mining company that I did in Canada. We did for like about a year and a half. Very inexperienced, and at that moment, a lot of learnings through that experience. We had some, I guess that was probably the case where it was just mostly a loss of capital. Mining is, if you don't have the right economics, you know, if you don't have the right setup, it doesn't work out as well. The second one, Verify, which is the one, let's say, I was most known for before Audio. Well, there we had a different, we were completely bootstrapped and we never raised any capital. And the way we paid ourselves in Bitcoin, we kind of like, it was our personal Bitcoin that we put into the company, and that's how we paid ourselves. And that lasted about 2 years before we got acquired. It was during the bear market, so I went very aggressively on the Bitcoin treasury, let's say, at that moment. But we did kind of, our sellers were kind of priced in Bitcoin, so it wasn't that much of a hit for the company. But it was, let's say, personally, it was a bit tougher. Let's say that was a theory I had back then. It's like you can, let's say, if you have a Bitcoin treasury, you can price the salaries in Bitcoin, which most of the time it's positive for the employees. However, at bear market times, it can be harder. But we were able to turn it profitably within, let's say, a year and a half. So it wasn't much of a, it was mostly a concern at the beginning. Then it became profitable. So it wasn't much of a concern later on. Then we worked at, we got acquired by Bull Bitcoin, which meant that all of our team transitioned at Bull Bitcoin. And well, there I just had a normal salary. With Swapito, so we had been bootstrapped for a year. It was mostly me working on it. Let's say I also have a contract job where I'm a writer at Bitcoin Optech, which is probably the most important Bitcoin technical newsletter that there is. So from that salary and just living frugally, I was able to bootstrap the business while my co-founder still had other jobs. But now that we got this investment for Aureo, the way I'm thinking of it, it's kind of being kind of prudent. I think 50-50 is the approach I'm taking. And I think it's a very prudent approach to have both as much in Bitcoin, as much in dollars. The first thing I would say is people don't realize the immediate expenses that you have when you start a startup. So just for example, talking about the legal costs related to the transaction, related to the licenses we've acquired, a lot of that is spent at the beginning. So you really want to be able to do that first, let's say, investment into legal costs, and also, let's say, have like a year and a half of like what's essential in runway. So that's kind of the strategy we figured with the dollars we have in the balance sheet. And the rest, well, the Bitcoin is just going to be there as something that will allow us to extend our runway. I think it will be successful at that. We'll see how the market goes. I think the key term here is adaptability. We never know where the market is going. So if it's going towards up, then it just extends our runway, and we're just happier about that. If it goes down, maybe we get more frugal, we adapt, we reduce costs, and we figure it out that way. So that's the approach I've been taking, 50-50. Most people tell me I'm probably the most conservative on my team in terms of how I want to have the treasury set up. People would tell me often 70%, 75%, which is something that I would consider now more at this price than let's say 2 months ago. And we're always ready to reallocate depending on the cost, on the profitability, on the revenue of the business as well. For now, our strategy with the revenue is to keep it all in Bitcoin. So naturally our treasury will just grow as much as we're able to, let's say, have the initial year and a half of runway fixed in dollars, that, let's say, have the dollars in the treasury ready to pay that. And hopefully within that time frame, we're able to generate, to get to a revenue level where the profits would go not only towards paying the expenses and accumulating more Bitcoin. So in that way, we would never touch on that Bitcoin that we've left aside, right? That's kind of the hope and the dream. We'll see where it goes, but that's kind of the philosophy I have around all this.
Well, thanks both of you for sharing that perspective. Super valuable, I think. And, you know, it's funny to hear you say, Goose, my team thinks I'm the conservative one with a 50% Bitcoin treasury. Even just 5 years ago in the startup world, I mean, these conversations weren't really there yet, right? And I think it's a very tactical approach, the way you have structured this deal. I mean, to your point, Michael, which I do want to highlight and stress, that you're kind of encouraging people to, Michael, with your comments, to think in Bitcoin, right? I mean, when you say Bitcoin is volatile relative to fiat, and when you're mentioning that people think that businesses won't create value on top of Bitcoin, you're really getting at the fundamental concept of which is the words you used. Bitcoin just really is money. So of course, where there's creativity and value creation, there will be Bitcoin returns on top of that, right, Michael? But you know, to some of your comments, Gustavo, of course, there's some heavy fiat expenses. We're in this transition moment and in this maturity of the cycle where you have to be tactical about how you manage a treasury, right? Whether that's on a personal level or as a business. So really insightful comments from you both there. And I mean, fascinating to see these deals kind of, you know, coming to light. I think there will be a lot of learnings from what you both have structured here. Maybe changing direction a little bit. I'd love to get into a little bit of the market opportunity in Latin America. Can you share some of your insights? We can start with you, Gustavo, on the Latin American market. What would you say is the makeup of crypto versus Bitcoin? How much does the regulation play a role country by country? You have a very unique lens into two very different markets and regulatory environments in Mexico and El Salvador.
Certainly. So the way I see the market, for example, in the United States, is that around the 2020, 2021 years, like a Bitcoin-only industry emerged. There had been Bitcoin startups previously that were like Bitcoin-only in the United States, but really the industry took off during those years. You had the arrival of OnRamp, Unchained, Swan, Strike, River, you know, all these companies. So that moment, that transition, which has led us to the point we're in today, hasn't happened yet in markets such as Mexico or other Latin American countries, or is in my thesis on the verge of happening or currently happening with projects like mine. So when I got to Mexico, that was probably the first thing I noticed is how everything is still centered on the crypto thesis, how this is just gambling or these are the riskiest assets you can invest in. So it's got a crowd of young people that want to gamble, want to turn $100 into maybe potential life-changing money. And that's the narrative. That's how it's framed. That's how it's seen. I would say that that I'm finally seeing that transition at the same time. I think this is the moment we're in where we're finally seeing people wake up to this new narrative. Then on the regulatory front, I would say that Mexico is an interesting case because it has a lot of confusing legislations that could make you think you need this license to operate this type of platform in Mexico. You need a fintech license. However, that's not how it works. It was thought in the, let's say, late 2010s that the fintech license could be the framework for crypto or Bitcoin companies, but it was later changed, particularly through the Central Bank of Mexico's actions. They were very aggressive on not allowing Bitcoin companies and crypto companies to be part of the financial system. So now you had initially a legislation that the goal was to create a legal framework for these companies, but then it was intercepted by the central bank, who said, this is not happening. So people are still with the idea that the fintech license is strictly related to say operating a Bitcoin platform in Mexico. And it's not. Instead, you need to do what we do, and you just need to comply with the anti-money laundering legislation, which is just something separate. And as long as you register and you work with the fiscal authorities, specifically the SAT, then you can operate any form of crypto Bitcoin entity in Mexico. El Salvador, on the other hand, has a very extensive framework on what you are required to obtain as a license, and it's completely legitimized, let's say, and integrated into their financial system. So we went to El Salvador because of that specific reason. We think it's the country in the region with the most advanced framework. Plus, we can operate that offshore entity, let's say the Salvador entity, we can operate it in Mexico as long as we get the authorization I was talking about from fiscal authorities. So that comes together as the, in my opinion, the perfect framework or the perfect package to operate both in Mexico and El Salvador, but then in other countries replicate that same strategy where my head of Bitcoin operations is in El Salvador. That's where all the Bitcoin happens. And then I have all these local entities for local compliance and integration with their financial systems. So I guess it was challenging at first to understand this picture, because most lawyers you talk to will give you different answers, different price points. That's just a classic cost of business in Latin America. It's that things aren't as standardized or formalized as they are in the United States and Canada, where I was used to do more business. But I guess that's just, once again, the topic of adaptability, right? When you get to a new market, you just have to understand the cost of doing businesses or the traditions of how business is done. Doing a lot of deep digging into how it works legally was one of those challenges, but it's something that I believe we have figured out at this point.
Nicole, from your perspective, you've been involved with multi-institutional custody through OnRamp, and Early Riders being both entities that you kind of sit on top of in terms of a leadership role. When you started talking with Gustavo, did you view Aria as perhaps a better way of entering the LATAM market and taking advantage of the LATAM opportunity rather than expanding OnRamp into LATAM? Was that part of your vision, as I can work, you know, with a partnership between OnRamp and Aria in an easier way with boots on the ground than I could just taking my company and expanding it into LATAM? Or what was your kind of, how did you look at that opportunity versus, you know, investing in Gustavo and Aria versus just doing it directly?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I think from a core philosophy perspective, I think a lot of builders miss and existing crypto companies miss like a very basic premise that Bitcoin's money. And if it is money, it's not like technology and application, then it requires financial services. And financial services require, or what basically built world-class financial services, are relationships. And relationships are all based on trust, but they're also based on trust that's local. So it's kind of crazy when you think about, for any firm to sit and try to be a global powerhouse in Bitcoin, because over time, people will just want, this is the reason why you go in the United States and almost any country, and there's a set number of bank branches on a corner or local banks, because that's just how financial services has been managed for hundreds, if not much longer, thousands of years. You didn't send your gold, maybe in the post Bretton Woods area to the United States, but generally it was housed in custody within your sovereign nation. We kind of see this happening today with gold. So point being is the vision has always been that not only will multi-institution and the keys be distributed across the world, and they'll be regulated and institutions that are managing and winning the client relationship, and we're powering from an infrastructure perspective. That was always the stance, and we always knew we would partner with other firms in different regions. Going back to some of what Israel was asking and what Gustavo was sharing, is it's a really fascinating landscape. The U.S. gets a lot of flack for whether it's the just different things across the board, whether it's the DEI, ESG, like we have no shortage of mistakes, pitfalls, whatever people might want to say. But the thing we do have is really robust, sophisticated capital markets all the way down to like crypto and specifically Bitcoin. Think about how many Bitcoin VCs are based in the United States. Think about how many Bitcoin only companies exist in the United States. This doesn't exist in most of the world. And there's Bitcoiners there. There's Bitcoin investors, enthusiasts, but it gets really hard for those individuals not only to start businesses, but also for capital formation to happen there on a Bitcoin only way. Because if you guys remember back in like 2018, 19, it was almost impossible to build a Bitcoin only business because traditional venture capital was all related to crypto. So when you take that lens and then you add to it, this is something that was a real eye opener for me. Whether you go to Dubai, Singapore, Latin America, the majority of wealth is English speaking, Western trained. When you think about schooling, and they really, independent of that, they all require the same thing. It's like, it's almost like oxygen and water to exist. Like the financial services, when you think about trust requirements on liabilities, accountability, like that exists across the world when it comes to managing capital. And so when we look at like what we're building and the need for multi-institution, it translates all regions and all boundaries. But the interesting aspect is, and we saw this firsthand with our sister company, OnRamp MENA in the GCC, is that they're ultra sophisticated in crypto. They over-index. They went super hard in whatever sophisticated in crypto would mean, right? Stable coins, perpetual futures, all the different stuff that exists. But they don't have any robust infrastructure for Bitcoin, even though, again, it's still market cap weighted, the dominant pair that people trade, hold, custody long term. And so we just look at this as a huge asymmetry, especially as the large banks and fintechs start to go really heavy into Bitcoin only. I think one of probably the most sophisticated in Latin America is Nubank. It's my understanding that their leadership is pretty far down the rabbit hole as far as understanding Bitcoin. It's been shown in public record. They just brought on Michael Riani, who was formerly Cash App and then leading Bitcoin at Coinbase over there. But point being is that there's still not a lot of infrastructure in Latin America. And so our thesis is kind of similar to what we've seen in Africa with a lot of fintechs, that there is a world where you can bypass a lot of the crypto noise and speculation if you can build the right education, the right market structure, the right products and services. And so you tie all that together. And then we met Gustavo. And the interesting anecdote you'll probably appreciate with Gustavo is he was explaining what he's building. We're like, look, we love it. We love all of it that we just talked about. But it wasn't a tough conversation. It was just an intentional and honest conversation. It was like, we can't really invest unless you guys are interested in what we're doing on the multi-institution side. And the reason why is because we believe we're aiming to invest in category winners in markets. And we believe the category winner will be built on multi-institution for X, Y, and Z reason. And it's huge credit for Gustavo, because a lot of people could have said like, kick rocks, I'm out, you're telling me what to do. But like a real good founder at least listens. They hear, right? You're always hearing. I tell my team all the time, I'm always listening. Now, if I don't go along with it, that's a different story, but I'm listening, because if you don't listen, you don't learn. How can you ever grow? And so point being is Gustavo went back and said, let me talk. And he came back after a few weeks. He said, I've been talking to my brain trust. I've been discussing different opportunities in the market and for a few months now. And I shared with them this opportunity. They said, this is the best idea you've had for a while, as far as like what this could mean. And there's all these things that we know about, whether across the world, there's crime rates spiking, there's a lack of comfortability around custody, and how do you even know how to buy it? How do you get off zero? Because most people, again, do not want to deal with a hardware device in 12 words. They don't want to trust a single entity, because all they've heard is everyone's always lost in the asset. So you tie all that together, and it just is a recipe for a great opportunity for that market.
Well, it's certainly lots of synergies there, and makes a great deal of sense, you know, on the multi-institutional custody model that you speak to, Michael. One thing that comes to mind is, I think people, what's underappreciated about Bitcoin is the fact that you can custody it in a multi-party fashion because of its portability and digital characteristics. You know, good luck trying to do that with other hard money such as gold, you know. So It's I think, a big opportunity and very advantageous to be able to plug into those attributes of Bitcoin and create very risk mitigated models, such as the approach that you guys are taking. And let's maybe get into a little bit of the roadmap and vision of both of your companies. What's some of the future offerings? I mean, you guys have already been doing a lot. You kind of mentioned to the fact that you expanded into the Middle East, of course. In the context of this conversation, you guys are now kind of extending yourselves into the Latin America region. On the early riders ecosystem side, you recently had an announcement on the stables and accelerator. Over the coming few years, what's your vision for the company, Michael?
Yeah, so I think one thing you said earlier that we can go deeper on if you want, or just to cover on it, is it doesn't get discussed enough. And I think the reason why is because the first 15 years, the pain hasn't been as acute. But I look at Bitcoin, when you think about it as a dollar, 10 cents, a dollar, $10, even $10,000, you have fundamentally different problems than when it's $100,000 and $1 million. And so for the first 15 years, I don't believe we've actually understood what really will make Bitcoin different and more successful than gold, because I think that's the thing people forget about. Gold still is actually money. Like when you think about net settling and, you know, sovereign assets, it's a $30 trillion asset. It's just an insane, it's the largest asset in the world. But gold failed because it's centralized. And where I believe Bitcoin perfects what gold did was not necessarily around the fixed supply or even the number, because again, this is not me advocating for it. It's just trying to contextualize. What I'm saying is that there could be 23 million or 19 million Bitcoin, and the number is somewhat arbitrary. And then you could, again, I'm not advocating, but you could have some level of inflation, and gold had inflation. It still served as money. The thing that I believe makes gold or Bitcoin different than gold, and you brought this up, Israel, is the fact that you can insert governance at the asset layer. That had never historically been able to happen because things were physical. And so you had to custody it with one counterparty. And so when you extrapolate long term, whether it's sovereigns, ETFs, large financial institutions, this ability to insert governance where no single entity can move or lose the assets will help in not only the growth of the asset and building robust market structure so people can invest large amounts of Bitcoin or dollars or their local fiat without feeling that it'll, you know, go up in smoke, but also it'll allow it to grow and have the right market structure where you won't have paper games on it and have these like claims, because there goes back to the other side that Audio also supports, is the ability to take delivery, because you need both sides. You need that inherent base. And so then the other side of it is we're talking about it in theory, but just to break down, like when you have a business, a financial service business that can generate revenue on the trade, but also on the reoccurring revenue with custody, not only do you have just a more foundational, structurally strong business, because the unit economics don't have to necessarily just come from trades. You can even underprice your competitors because you're not only solely trying to make your money on the trade, but then you retain the client relationship. You can offer other financial services like loans on it, anything else you might want. And the last part that really gets widely misunderstood, especially by entrepreneurs in this space, is most of the products that are Bitcoin only, they just preach and say, we only want you to do self-custody. There's specific ones out there. And the thing they really don't recognize is when somebody buys, whether it's $10,000 or $1 million, and they get told to go put it on a Trezor with 12 or 24 words, they generally want to buy a lot more Bitcoin. But they're not provided a robust infrastructure to manage that. And so they only get the trade on what somebody's willing to like risk, because they still look at it as very risky. So we look at this as just like very foundational things. And that's what influences what we build at OnRamp. And we build a lot of products for the market, our clients today. But then where we're really going is how do we power other infrastructure companies? How do other companies that are going to offer lending on top of multi-institution, building an exchange in the United States on top of multi-institution in other countries? Because a great example is like proof of reserves. Proof of reserves, it's a good sentiment, but it doesn't really do anything in the sense that it doesn't prove your liabilities. But it also, more importantly, and very much under discussed, is if I prove my reserves today, if I had a centralized exchange and tomorrow the assets are lost because internally somebody colluded, there was a bad actor, the government came to me, it doesn't do anything that I could tell you yesterday that they were there and tomorrow they're not. Inherent to multi-institution is the first time in history, and specifically in Bitcoin, where any wallet can be attested by multiple independent institutions that these assets not only sit there, but they're governed by these different key holders or institutions. It's inherent to that is proof of reserves because they're on-chain auditable. And then tomorrow, God forbid, something happens to one of the exchange's custodians and they go away, your assets are still perfectly fine. And so again, these are just some of the themes that we will be playing and investing in, building on top of. Just expect as the market gets more educated, they naturally just become demanded because, again, we went back to 100% of people, like they need oxygen, water, they need assurances when they're going to allocate material amounts of money to Bitcoin. They can't just park it somewhere and then, God forbid, the house burns down, they lose all their money. That's just not a way for practical humans to invest in assets.
And Goose, what about Audio? What's the vision and product offerings for the coming, you know, 2-3 years?
Right now, you can buy and sell Bitcoin on Audio. You can on our web platform. The buy function is not fully automated. Before the end of the year, we're going to have a buy feature that's completely automated, so you'll have both the buy and the sell automated on the platform. Q1, we do expect strongly that we'll have a first MIC or multi-institution custody MVP, something we can offer that is Audio's, that we can offer to our customers in Latin America for their long-term investment thesis. That comes together with the buy and sell features that we have. We also in Q1 would like to, well, in Q4, we're also adding business accounts. So before the end of the year, we're also going to be able to onboard businesses. We can already do it manually, but we're working on an onboarding flow directly on the platform that's automated and it focuses on providing a good user experience. In Q1, on top of the multi-institution custody, we want to launch our first savings feature as well that will not only be able to set you up, let's say, a savings plan, but also be able to go and take the money from your bank account without you having to push the money. There are ways for in Mexico to build systems that can actually go and you can program, let's say, I want to save $1,000 a month. And that it's instantly taken from your bank account, sent to your multi-institution custody setup or external wallet, if that's what you prefer. So I think that will give us a pretty good start. From then, probably in 2026, the other things we want to do are the mobile app, also offering an API and just expanding our platform in those senses, adding more services. One core thing that we want to do in 2026 is also a lending product, basically Bitcoin collateralized loans denominated in pesos sent to your Mexican bank account. I don't think there's a solution for that yet in the market. So we're very excited to be able to offer that to the Mexican market and also to build it on top of multi-institution custody. And inheritance planning also comes along multi-institution custody. I think the what's core to understand here is how once you build the right foundation, which is multi-institution custody, you can then offer additional financial services that people need, which are very hard to offer from a, first of all, non-custodial point of view, or are not as secure to offer in a just single custodian view, right? So all of that together, I think will make an exciting next year. Other things we have in the pipeline are also the OTC desk, which we are already building and we're already offering to some clients. Prime brokerage as well. We're getting access to probably the best pricing accounts you can have in Mexico. That's been also a lot of my work is building these relationships so I can have access to just the best pricing. It's not as commoditized as in the US. Yeah, that's actually an important point. So let's say you launch a Bitcoin startup in Canada, in the US, in Europe, you have all this infrastructure that is already there for you to just plug and play, access to the best prime brokerage pricing, APIs for banking and trading. That isn't as complete here in Mexico. Maybe you have the fiat system is actually pretty good, but all the rest of the infrastructure hasn't been built yet. So there's a lot of work towards developing relationships with B2B partners in the region. So that's something that I'm focused on. And I think later on in the next year, this is something we'll be able to help other companies with. So not only serve clients, investors directly, that want to build a Bitcoin treasury for their business or have a personal Bitcoin investment, but also help other Bitcoin companies in Mexico and in the region to offer these services themselves to their clients and on their platforms. So that's kind of the idea. We are already hiring and we'll be hiring more on the development side, mostly also people to help us out to produce content. We're very focused on building the best educational content in Latin America for Bitcoin. I think with my background and my team's background that has been very concentrated on education and content, plus the community we're building in Mexico City, I think we have all what's necessary to build a great education, like onboarding journey, but also platform. So yeah, so those a lot of different things, but these are the things we're focused on, and we're very excited to deliver it to the market.
I'm really happy you mentioned the educational side, because to Israel's point earlier, LATAM, Mexico has been more crypto oriented than Bitcoin. And I just want to give a shout out to Gus, because you lead the monthly BitDevs meetups in Mexico City, and they're phenomenal. I mean, they are just exceptional content and education, and your knowledge and how you help share that with other people has seen that community grow. We used to be like 10 people, and now we have like 100 that sign up and 60 that come. But it's like you really are an inspiration to the community in building that. So I'm excited to see you. And then on your team, Magic also is contributing a lot. So thank you for all that you're doing in terms of the educational side of it. I guess as we're kind of coming to the top of the hour, I'm sure we could talk for a lot longer, but would love to just get some thoughts about how the two of you will be working closely together. I've already heard some great interplay about, you know, Michael, you talking about multi-institutional custody and just kind of opening Gus's perspective to how to integrate that into Aria. And Gus, you're realizing that that's kind of the way to build your company in the future. But how closely will you two work together, or what kind of synergies do you have in terms of advice or back and forth or strategic direction? Would love to hear a little bit more about the relationship that you two are building.
Yeah, I'll let Gustavo share more. But I think at the core, I think it gets really underestimated how, like, when you have a new custody format, right? It's never existed. It's very robust. It's pretty direct on how it works. But there's a heavy amount of education and learnings where we think when the market, where it eventually goes, is if everyone is going to hold Bitcoin to preserve their wealth, whether it's a business or individual, it'll just be secondary. It's like clicking a browser. You'll just know it works. You'll put your credit card information in. There was encryption. In the same way, like, you'll adopt and buy Bitcoin, you won't have to worry about the things that for the first 17 years people had to deal with. But the point being is, for the past 3 years, that's what we've been heavily focused on, from the sales repetitions to the marketing to the collateral. And so to the extent that we can help Aria and other portfolio companies in opening that up, that's something that we've been working with him on. And just across the board, because there's just a lot of inertia that we built by just focusing on this every day. And there's obviously other things that we do being active builders in this space. But I just wanted to call that out because I'm sure Gustavo has some other things he can share.
Yeah, well, I think I learned a lot from Michael and his team. You know, I appreciate a lot of all their feedback, because the way I see it is they're just further along on a similar mission than we are. They've run on-ram for many years. They've tried things that didn't work as well. They pivoted to things differently. So all these learnings and all the feedback I can get from Michael and really all of his team, Brian and Liam, have been all very valuable in our development. So that's something that I want to keep on doing, you know, talking to the early riders team, showing all of our progress, all the different things we're doing, asking questions, listening a lot. Also, as part of the, like, I think this was a Michael touch on this topic, is that naturally through the model of custody, of multi-institution custody, you need reliable partners and collaboration with other institutions. So that it also comes into play that the Aria and the OnRam team collaborate towards forming one of a quorum of multi-institutional custody. It will that the way that's formed, it will evolve with time as well. Audio will take on a more proactive role as time goes further in those multi-sig quorums related to multi-institution custody. So I guess there's a lot of both collaboration from the like conversations both from the founder and investor, but also collaborations between our team and the OnRamp team on building the best infrastructure for custody in Latin America.
As we come to close here, I'd like to maybe leave it off on a positive or fun tone. So a question for each of you. Life is full of uncertainty and change. We're certainly going through waves of that now. Why is Bitcoin a source of inspiration for you on a personal level?
Well, Bitcoin honestly has transformed the way I look at everything and the way I basically everything I do. So it at this point, I kind of just don't see myself doing something other than work building on Bitcoin. If it ever sinks, which I doubt it does, I will sink with it. But I just really like seeing others go through the same journey that I went through, whether it's customers, people within the community we have in Mexico City, friends and family, or just people that I meet on a regular basis, seeing how Bitcoin transforms their lives, how not only it transforms their investment thesis, but also how they dedicate their time or the things they work on. That's really what motivates me to keep going, to have that effect. If I can contribute to having that effect in people, that's what motivates me and in the end inspires me to build a company like Audio.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it ties back to something we didn't get to chat about in the beginning of the show, which was around business adoption of Bitcoin. I look at it as very binary in the sense of, because I still think on this podcast and in the market, it seems very theoretical around Bitcoin denominated or Bitcoin in your treasury. But I look at it as asymmetric in the sense that if a business doesn't adopt the Bitcoin on a long enough time horizon, they're going to go out of business. And so the core point to your question, Israel, is we need sound money to coordinate economic activity. Like for society to flourish, if you have the wrong foundation or the wrong denominator, you can't coordinate economic activity. You can't build net new businesses, or it makes it insanely hard and it's becoming harder. And so if you can open up the aperture around education, access to financial services, and make it easier to the point of where similarly putting your credit card information used to be crazy, now you put it online and it's generally secure, that needs to be in that same vein accessible for people just to preserve their wealth. Because again, it's just like oxygen or water, you need it to survive. And so that's personally what, you know, keeps me moving and on this track and going there is after the years of building and self-custody and realizing the limitations around education and all the things, you need to build both sides of education and then the products on the other side of it for anybody to be able to park material amounts of Bitcoin and not have to worry about all the crazy what's happened for 17 years in the sense of the boundaries or the leaps that somebody had to take to put money in Bitcoin. If we all go back to our journey, how long it took just to feel comfortable with parking 1 to 10 to 50%. That's just not like practical or relevant, or will take so much longer versus if we create the right robust tooling for them. And so that's really the interesting part around OnRamp. And then also on the investment, if we can accelerate not only multi-institution, but the right founders to build in this area, it's also going to be very lucrative because as we talked about, all these businesses eventually will realize that they need more robust infrastructure that's dedicated to this like asset that takes up the majority of the market cap in the crypto space.
As we close out, can we get each of you to also just kind of direct people to where they can follow the journey of Ario and OnRamp and early riders? Are you speaking at any upcoming conferences, or what's the best way to keep in touch?
Yeah, on our side, you can go to onrampbitcoin.com or earlyriders.com. We put out a lot of content, weekly newsletters. So we pretty much build out in the open. So we don't really, we're a pretty open book. And then we have multiple weekly podcasts. The Last Trade is probably the most known, again, where we talk about a lot of these concepts weekly. So you're more than welcome to follow us there. And if you ever have questions or interest in anything we're doing or looking to get funded, please reach out, michael@earlyriders.com.
Thank you, Israel, Lynn, and Michael. On our end, you can go to audiobitcoin.com. You can find on our website all of our services, and you can reach out directly to me from the website or through my email, which is gustavo@audiobitcoin.com. We are also in the process of launching a lot of content, so stay tuned for that. I think it for us it, right now, we're at a stage where we want to talk to everyone that's involved in a Bitcoin community in Mexico, Latin America, that has been talking to their friends and family about Bitcoin in Mexico and has not found a reliable platform to recommend them to. So if that's your situation and you're in Mexico and you're excited about Bitcoin but haven't yet found the right solution to recommend to your friends and family, we think Audio is going to play exactly that role. So reach out to us to have any sorts of conversations.
Well, we'll certainly include all of that information in the show notes. And we really appreciate the time from both of you and sharing all your perspectives, vision, and of course, everything that you're building. And hopefully we'll get you back on in the near future with some more updates. But for now, appreciate it and take care, Michael and Goose.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. I'm looking forward to attending the Mexico City meetup in 2026. So we'll have to coordinate when you're down there as well. We'll all get together. I've seen those barbecue grill outs on Twitter. I'm looking forward to participating.
It gets pretty good. Thank you, everyone.